Hello, you're listening to the 10x9 Lockdown Podcast. I'm Paul Doran, co-founder with Padraig O'Toole of 10x9. 9 people, 10 minutes, true story, own life. Simple. Even though some lockdown restrictions are being eased, it may be some time until we can return to our Belfast home, the Black Box. So we've moved to Zoom on a fortnightly basis. The stories are amazing as always, and our audience, the best. We have 3 stories on this podcast for you. The first was told at our Zoom event on May the 13th when the theme was holidays. It's told by Linda Faith Kelly, who re-recorded it for us, as Zoom recordings can be a bit hit and miss. So take it away, Linda.
I was tired of London, and yes, sorry Dr. Johnson, but I was tired of my life. Tired of crawling from one side of the city to the other, spending hours of the day on a variety of commutes, from walk, tube, walk, work, minibus stuck in traffic, to walk, tube, walk, new but frequently breaking down Docklands Light Railway, to walk, tube, walk, freezing cold boat on the Thames, not very Elizabeth I, more Anne Boleyn. I'd had a holiday in Turkey, a blissful week of sunshine, good food, wonderful scenery, interesting people, and more respect as a lone woman traveller from the Muslim men of that country than I usually received from many of the middle-aged male journalists I worked with. So I handed in my notice and planned a bigger holiday to India, which some friends often talked enthusiastically about. I would maybe head further east afterwards and end up in Hong Kong, where I was assured I'd soon land a good job if the money was running out. I'd also spotted a news story about an organisation called the Survival Club, which was planning the first rubbish clearing expedition to Everest Base Camp, increasingly messed up by climbers abandoning their waste there before embarking on the final push to the top of the mountain. I contacted the organisers, arranged to meet them in Kathmandu after my Indian trip, with the promise of providing media publicity. ITN lent me a small video camera and a contract to provide footage. But I didn't like India. As a woman travelling alone, I was often harassed and asked, "Where is your husband?" I hadn't met him yet, so I didn't know. I found it hard to decide on my policy towards beggars. Give something to everyone, but then the word got round and more appeared, trapping me in a crowd of outstretched hands and pitiful cries. Or be the hard heart who ignores all. Neither was a solution. I spent a hard month in India, not a holiday. So I looked forward to Kathmandu, especially as I bumped into someone I knew from London but hadn't seen for a few years at the airport, and we had a few beers together. This seemed to bode well. I'd handed over my bag of trekking gear to one of the organisers in London, and he'd put it on the plane the rest of the group were travelling in. But it didn't arrive, and there wasn't time to chase and harangue the airline for the loss. Gone were my comfortable worn-in walking boots, my ex-army trekking trousers, and a variety of layers of clothes to cope with the increasing cold as we headed up to 5,360 metres and minus 20 degrees centigrade. I scoured the second-hand shops of Kathmandu for other people's boots, clothes and backpacks. We called them rucksacks in the 80s, by the way. Few of us had met before, and probably just as well. Students, civil servants, a solicitor, a shepherdess. Many different types and temperaments who didn't all like each other. Cleaning up base camp was the easy part, getting there the challenge. Pain and pressure erupted into snapping and occasional screaming, but it never came to blows, only just. Kathmandu itself was a culture shock for some, with near medieval ways of life, goat's heads for sale, prayer wheels and kaftans not seen since the 60s, a street fight between a dog and a rat on a lead, the rat lost. Sacrifices in the city of animals whose blood was sprinkled on buses and scooters and on the wings of the twin otter planes flying us up 2,800 metres to Lukla, where our walk would begin. I thought my last moment had come when the plane headed straight for a cliff before swooping onto a sloping mountainside airstrip. When I opened my eyes, I was surprised and exhilarated to still be alive. A small army of Sherpas, porters and cooks looked after us, laughing at our bodies slowing down as we tried to adapt to high altitude and extreme cold. They sped up ahead of us in flip-flops or barefoot, some hanging back to assist the weak Westerners as they failed to keep up. One of our group was a doctor, kept busy administering to injuries and the severe headaches, nausea, dizziness and exhaustion of ASM, acute mountain sickness. If not dealt with either by going back down the mountain or taking the right drugs within 24 hours, the result can be pulmonary and cerebral edema and death. As I succumbed to ASM, suffering from lack of oxygen and hardly able to walk, Kathy, a former nurse, fed me glucose tablets, and ex-paratroopers Mike and Bob carried my day sack. Kevin, a Royal Navy submariner, walked behind to encourage and, if necessary, carry me. The night I suffered those headaches and nausea, I felt as if I no longer wanted to live, but the drugs worked their miracle overnight, and I woke up refreshed and amazed at their effect. There were also torn ligaments, chest infections, stomach bugs, and constant whinging, not all of it from me. Other walkers we met were not so well looked after by their companions. A Belgian man suffering AMS was found abandoned and barely alive in his tent by doctors from the Himalayan Rescue Association. Sherpas carried a 16-stone Frenchman down the mountain on their backs, but he died. Our doctor, Sandy, had to deal with the corpse of an 80-year-old German man who had collapsed. Pushing your body to the limits also means respecting those limits and unaccustomed conditions. There were compensations, stunning snow-capped mountains, breathtaking views, and skies of changing light and colours, clouds twisting around the mountaintops. Even a nighttime trip to the open-air toilet had its rewards, as that was the most magnificent time to see moon, stars, the Milky Way, shooting stars close enough I felt I could touch them. There were tedious times too as we plodded along, conversations sometimes on the meaning of life and Kierkegaard. There was a philosophy research student in the group, but others on the increasing price of chocolate as we climbed to higher villages, and of course the state of our bowels. Half the group had volunteered to help a nutritionist by weighing and recording food input and urine output. There was a competition to see who had the most. Warmer clothes and thermal underwear did not come off for days. Washing was abandoned as soap and flannels froze solid. Table manners deteriorated in the battle to consume enough carbohydrates. Ice formed inside the flimsy tents. The only way I could maintain the video camera's batteries was to sleep with them inside my sleeping bag. Base camp was an ugly, rocky place, resembling a city rubbish tip, unsuitable for camping, so we pitched our tents at Gorak Shep, 200 metres lower, and made daily cleaning trips. We filled bin liners with tin cans, cooking utensils, medical equipment. Some were taken down the mountain, some thrown into deep crevasses to be ground into dust. Paper and plastic were burnt. We thought we'd started something, but in the years since I've read things have got as bad as ever, or worse. Base camp has had to be closed because of too many trekkers and also earthquakes. The reincarnate Lama of Tangaboche, a Buddhist monastery on the Everest route, said, "Each place has its own god. The power of the god causes the energy in the earth, the fertility and the flow of water to flow in harmony with the needs of man. If we go on the mountain and make it dirty with foul smells, the god may be offended and eventually will leave, upsetting the balance of energies in the land. And today, as we suffer the effects of a lethal virus, what have we done this time to upset the balance of energies? Will we ever find out?"
What indeed, Linda. What indeed. Thanks so much. I think I'll stick to the foothills of the Mourns. Now, if you want to join our Zoom events, and we've people from all over the world joining us, go to our website, 10by9.com, and register. And if you want to tell a story, get in touch. If you're unsure of anything, just check out our guidelines on the website. In fact, everything you need to know about 10by9 is there. Okay, next we have a first-timer at the 10by9 mic. Stephen McCrory emailed this story about a family holiday after our May 13th event, but it's a cracking yarn. So here it is.
It had not been a great year. Although my wife's treatment for breast cancer was going well, we still carried a mantle of anxiety and fatigue. In addition, the medical confirmation of something we already internally accepted, namely my 67-year-old father's early dementia, threw a heavy wet woolen blanket of disbelieving despair over that mantle. The holiday was my mother's idea. Desperate for a little bit of light, she said, "Let's go away. Somewhere nice, somewhere hot." And whilst I wrestled with that idea, with the responsibility of leading our damaged family on a summer break, a holiday was booked, and to Portugal we went. And it was great. The kids had a ball, in and out of the pool, throwing themselves into the daily entertainment laid on for them. Gradually, we relaxed. We exhaled. And believing we were on top of things, sure, it was all fine. We booked a day out. We booked the Jeep Safari. On the next day, suitably attired, laden down with good things to eat, we wandered down to the centre of the village. My wife, looking stunning, though her hair was still a bit short to be fashionable. My children, Faye, 8, enthusiastic, gung-ho. Peter, 4, funny and boisterous. My mother, glamorous as ever, coiffure and attire under tight control. And my father, an all too recently retired senior civil servant, still standing tall, but following rather than leading. As we approached our rendezvous, passing dazzling adobe villas, he nudged my wife and said, without a hint of irony, "Bangor's fair changed, hasn't it?" To which my wife replied, "Yes, it has, Bill." We were allocated a driver and clambered into the back of an open-topped Spanish Land Rover lookalike. Within minutes, we were bouncing around as the Jeep climbed up slowly gravel lanes into the hills that fringe the Algarve. The views were stunning, the colours magnificent. We stopped at a farm where the children could pet animals and crafts could be perused. Lunch was served, a classic puri puri chicken, but the thing that stood out at lunch was the wine. Appropriately, it was a white. Beyond that, things went rapidly downhill. Accordingly, 2/3 of it sat undrunk at the end of the meal. The kids ran off for one last pet of the goats, and I returned to purchase some artisanal goods, leaving my dad to rest. When we returned, however, the wine was gone. The bottle was still there, but now it was empty. To this day, I've no idea how he achieved it, but Dad had drunk the lot and now dozed peacefully in his chair. We roused him, ushered the children into the back of the Jeep, and were off again. And within the hour, we reached our next stop, the lake. By now, it was scorchingly hot, and Pedro indicated, and we gratefully accepted, that it was time to swim. Now, my father had been a champion swimmer in his youth, and after changing, he set off with long, languid strokes across the lake. I accompanied him, and when we reached the far side, I indicated that we should return. And as we neared the shore, I heard the jeeps beeping their horns, indicating that swim time was over. I hurried to the beach and helped the children ashore, where my wife and I dried and dressed them. Pointing them in the direction of my grandmother, or their grandmother, my wife said, "Where's your dad?" "Where's my dad?" I looked along the shore. No, just other families packing up. I looked across the lake. No, calm and empty. I looked along the lake, and squinting into the sun, in the distance, I could detect the slow rising and falling of my father's front crawl. I ran back into the water and began the chase. Now, I'm no swimming slouch, but by the time I drew near, he was starting to wade waist deep towards the shore, where a second phalanx of jeeps had pulled up. Young men were piling out of them and running into the water, and as I struggled to draw near, my father started to splash them. Not in a gentle sort of splish splash sort of way, but in a full on Pete Townshend, both arms going round, windmill sort of a way. I laid my hand upon his shoulder. He turned to me and his face turned from glee to shock. "You?" "Yes, Dad, I know. We have to go." We swam back up the lake as quickly as we could to where Pedro and the other drivers were hopping and pacing. We clambered on board, dripping in our swimmers, and the jeeps roared off and up onto the plateau. The gravel track spread out. We climbed to a massive flat plain. The jeeps fanned out and then ran along each other side by side. The hot air was only beginning to dry the dust onto my skin when the water began to hit us. Pedro indicated the trunk in the back and I opened it and pulled out loaded super soaker water pistols ready to go. The passengers in the other jeeps had already started the water war and we were their intended targets. I armed my squealing kids. Dad, initially startled, suddenly got it and he grabbed a weapon. Ignoring Pedro's remonstrations, he grabbed the bars of the jeep and stood. Bracing himself against the bumps, he poured water first into one jeep and then into another. As we approached the road and the water ran dry, he raised his water pistol to the sky and let out a piercing, "Yee-haw!" He was Butch Cassidy. He was Wild Bill Hickok. He was Billy the Kid. When we arrived back at the complex, having thanked Pedro vigorously and tipped him generously, we were exhausted, hungry, and thickly coated in a fine orange dust which never washed out of our clothes. My mother's makeup was askance and her hair looked like bracken in the autumn. We were beat, but not beaten, and my father still had a glint in his eye. Dementia is a tough, tough thing for those who suffer it, and possibly even harder for those who care for them. But occasionally there's a silver lining, glinting briefly and slither thin, but they're to be treasured in the present and in the future as a momentary glimpse into the past.
Thanks so much for that, Stephen. By the way, we are open to anyone sending us a story for inclusion on the podcast, regardless of theme. Email us at story@10by9.com. Also, you can see all our Zoom events on our YouTube channel, so go check them out. 10by9 is always free and always will be, but we do have a Patreon page if you'd like to help cover our overheads and keep us going through this period. So a big thank you to everyone who has very kindly donated. And now, here's our final story, and it's from another first-timer. The theme was lockdown, and it was May 27th. Here's Miriam Ullman.
When I was a kid, we knew the names of all of our suppliers, and they knew ours. There was Jimmy the Breadman, Teddy the Milkman, and John the Butcher, Mr. Heffernan the Chemist, Miss Farrington the Haberdasher, and Mr. Dowling the Grocer. There was Dollar Daly, who ran the hardware store, and most importantly for us as kids, Jerry and Anna Lynn, who ran the sweet and ice cream shop. This was not rural Ireland in the early 60s. This was suburban Dublin. And we were a community. We stayed local, we shopped local, and kids were identifiably linked to their parents. Parents linked to other parents. There was little chance of getting lost or disappearing. We were all connected. Move on 50 plus years, and I'm back in a similar situation, though in a different city, in the time of COVID-19. The names are different. Michael the Fruit and Veg Man, Martin the Milkman, Victoria the Breadwoman, John D the Butcher, the guys in Moran Seafood, Kieran and Sawyers for the more indulgent moments. The list is growing. All of them leaving their goods on the doorstep and waving like disappearing relatives from the end of the path. Friends have a different set of suppliers. We are all growing relationships as the weeks of lockdown proceed. And if we all do as we say we will, as we continue to live with COVID and shop local, our sense of connection will be better for it. I've always felt a bit uneasy about the giant supermarkets. Always that feeling gnawed away that they were pulling the wool over my eyes, manipulating me psychologically with their tricks, their smoke and mirrors, shuffling the products around the store to induce me to spend more, seducing me to spend sometimes crazily. Profit was their primary driver, And no matter how much they said they did it all for me, the customer, I knew deep down it was the filthy lucre that propelled them forward, shortchanging their suppliers, wreaking havoc on growers, on communities, and on us, the gormless customers. I was never a big fan, and I'm glad to say that when, as I saw it, a line was crossed last year, I took a stand against the behemoth. It started in what I describe as the self-service corral, that area in large supermarkets, where without any interview or selection process, we take on the role of part-time workers, unloading, scanning, paying, packing, until a computerized voice, barely keeping its irritation in check, chivvies us along to speed up. No relationship or connection there. The problem was that my carton of eggs wouldn't scan, so I looked for one of those people who deserve a medal for their patience and who seem to go on automatic, stabbing their fingers at the checkout machine in a frenzied way, usually walking away without any eye contact at all. And who can blame them? No relationship there either. The eggs, however, still refused to scan. The problem, it seemed, was that the long number beside the barcode had not been properly entered. And so, to my jaw-dropping astonishment, I was instructed on how I should rectify the problem. A button with the words "enter code" was pointed out to me. My job description had just been extended. I looked at the woman as respectfully as I could, shaking my head, clearly indicating that I wouldn't be doing that. Back home, and without delay, I got the name of the store manager, we'll call him Archie, and proceeded to write to him. I laid out my stall. I was a customer, not an employee. I liked his store. I had been loyal. But on this, I was not willing to move. I pointed out that there were 20 self-service tills and only 2 service tills in the store. I was not, I wrote, going to continue to support the increase of profits and the reduction of the workforce. Shopping should be about human contact, a social outing of sorts. I believed, I said, that self-service tills kill connection. And to this end, I told him I would now be using service tills only. Archie responded with the £20 voucher, appreciating that I'd taken the time to write and suggesting that he would consider my views, and offered, clearly having worked out somehow my age demographic, assistance in using his smart shop scanning option. He had completely missed the point. Intentionally, I think. And pointless as it might be, I felt one more letter forming. I do have to fess up at this stage that I did cash in the £20 voucher. Filthy lucre indeed. Prior to shooting off a final salvo, I returned to the store. And as I lined up at the service till, the trolley behind nudged me accidentally. Once the over-effusive apologies and acceptances fizzed out, I shared with this fellow customer, a woman, my surprise that there was not a cucumber to be had in the store that day. We agreed it must be the hot weather. "I've one in the fridge at home," she told me, a tad conspiratorially, to which I responded, "What's your address?" And quick as a flash, she said, "You must be joking. I'm going home to put it on eBay." We laughed long and loud. I paid my bill and departed, still laughing. And as I looked back, I saw that she was still laughing too. So when I did respond to Archie, informing him that he had entirely missed the various points that I was making, quelle surprise, I shared the story of the cucumber, the other customer, our exchange and connection. That, I said, was my main point. Connection is being lost in automation. Shopping should offer us the chance to connect. It should enhance and not diminish our lives. I'm not so naive as to think that my stand will in any way alter the strategy of these enormous supermarket giants. No matter what their expensive advertising campaign tell us, they're in the business of selling food only to make massive profits. End of. So back to COVID-19, this strange and extraordinary time, and possible good outcomes. Back to the list of small suppliers that I'm getting to know slowly. Just the other day, having submitted my fruit and veg order to Michael, I realized that I had omitted the blueberries. So apologetically, I sent a follow-up email asking if they could be added. I think the response I got was, "No problem, Miriam, X." Cute, I thought. I think the X was an error or an automatic inclusion beside his name, but I'm going to go with the idea that it was intended and that Michael is going to know me by name as a valued and familiar customer with whom a connection can be made and human life and contact enhanced. So here's to a future as we manage our lives with a virus and aspire to hold onto some vague hope that good can emerge. At the start of it all, I heard someone talk about us living in the shelter of one another rather than in the shadow, and I like that. All of us small people will have to work very hard, though, to create opportunities out of this vast crisis, making decisions and better choices for how we live within our communities locally and safely. Because as Shirley Chisholm, a Black American activist, warned ominously, when morality comes up against profit, it is seldom the profit loses.
That was magnificent. Great to hear it. I was delighted that you spent the £20 voucher. Yeah, we're all with you there. Wonderful. It's great to do. I remember one time I texted somebody and I put an X at the end of it, and it was a colleague at work, and then I had to really, really embarrassingly go back to them and tell them that I didn't actually mean to send a kiss to them at work. And then they wrote back saying that they wanted more kisses the next time. She thought it was hilarious, but I was mortified.
Can I briefly butt in? Padraig, I remember once when I was going to work one Sunday morning and I was texting you a mixture of romance and theology, and I actually sent it to the press officer for Sinn Féin.
And there was another time that I was texting a very, very amorous and absolutely not for public consumption text message of love to Paul, and I accidentally sent it to my father. But that's a story that I'll have to tell everybody another time, because it does require a full 10 minutes.
You can never be too careful with technology. It gets us all in the end. Thanks so much, Miriam. And that is it from this podcast. Be sure to follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and of course, Instagram. Check out the website and get in touch. This podcast was written, produced, presented, mixed, and published by Paul Doran. Me, in other words. I'll be back with another podcast soon. Until then, stay safe.